This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news and intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversations. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good evening, Bahamas. This is The Urologist Speaks with Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto. We have a very interesting and inspiring and positive show. It's time for some positivity in our community, in our nation. We have three young general surgeons who are homegrown, who have aspirations and plans to go on and do specialized training and fellowships. And that's continuing what Dr. Wesley Francis and I were discussing last week in terms of there's a lot of positivity at PMH. PMH is getting a bad name. Obviously, no system is perfect. No hospital is perfect. But within the walls, there are a lot of beautiful roses growing out of the cracks. And three of them are right here. So there are three female surgeons who are in the country at this time, and two of them are here. And that would be Dr. Krista Nottage and Dr. Delicia Bodie. And we also have male general surgeon. We're going to mix it up with the male and females, and that's Dr. Holly Nixon. So good evening to all three of you.
Good evening. Thanks for having us.
So we start the show, as always, with a few inspiring quotes. Let me start with saying it. It is never too late to be what you might have been. The best way to get started is to quit talking and to begin doing. We may encounter many defeats, but we must not be defeated. When we talk about PMH, everybody has a negative connotation. When you go through the general surgery program, and as we mentioned last week with Dr. Wesley Francis, who unfortunately is stuck in emergency surgery at this time, and I just came out of emergency surgery three minutes ago, so I'm thankful that I made it. We don't talk about the positive things that are going on. So we have a very solid and well-recognized surgical program that's going over more than 15 years. I would even say even more than that, because even before I went off to school, it was just in its infancy stage. So I think that's going back to 2007, at least 2006. So it's been around, we're almost coming up on 20 years. Time really goes fast. And it's very well recognized. So essentially, it's to the point where basically every general surgeon who has come through the University of the West Indies through the PMH program is going off to do super specialized training, and that they're bringing in, most of them are coming back, and that's the good news. In the past, a lot of specialists didn't come back. Now we have a lot of homegrown physicians who have been in the trenches, gone through hell. We're going to talk about what life is in PMH, all the trials and tribulations, but we're going to talk about the positivity. So let's start with Dr. Delicia Bodie. Tell us about yourself. Where did you go to high school? Tell us about your family. Tell us about your struggles and your tribulations and going through that arduous general surgery program. And a lot of persons would say, one of my heroes, Dr. Danebo, would say, if you were to do it again, you would never go through that hell of doing residency. Residency is a living hell. Every day is an ordeal that you have to take it one day at a time, because the pressure is so enormous. It'll crush most persons. So you have to be brilliant to be a surgeon. You have to have a good bedside manner. You have to have good surgical skills and good hand coordination, etc. But you have to have a very strong backbone. You have to have a strong character, and you have to go with the ups and downs. You're going to get knocked down 100 times. You're going to be cursed. You're going to be shouted at. A lot of the senior trainees and professors, here and abroad are very demeaning, and they do it not in a mean-spirited way, but they want to make you stronger and realize that they want the best for you, because we're really the only, one of the very few professions where if you have a bad day, you can kill somebody, and mm-hmm. you don't want to live like that. So you take that hell so that you can become greater. So where did you go to high school? Are you from New Providence, Dr. Delicia Bowie?
So just to clear all rumors, I was born in New Providence, raised in Grand Bahama. So most persons know me from Grand Bahama, growing up from Grand Bahama, graduated from Bishop Michael Eldon High School, formerly Freeport Anglican High School. And shortly after graduation, went off to university, did my first year actually at Dalhousie, undergoing biochem, and found out about the pre-med program at the University of West Indies in Trinidad, and switched gears there, successfully got through and entered medical school at UWE. After our usual first 3 years, came back home, did the last two clinical years, met these two lovely persons, and have finished MBBS. We all finished the same year, 2014, so we've been bonded from that time. And we decided, I think the second year SHO, we joined residency through UWE, and we've been together since then. yes, residency is make it or break it. I think all of us can attest to that, especially it's not something that many persons will get through the first time, and we can all share our various experiences, but we've made it through and we're here today.
Well, you're stronger on the other end of it. Holly Nixon, where are you from? What high school did you go to? Tell us about your family, your experiences with the surgical program at the Princess Margaret Hospital in UWI.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Pinto, for having me on the show. So I born in Bahamas. I went to William Gordon Primary School and then all day secondary school. I did my undergrad studies at Kaiser Junior College, where I obtained an associate degree in medical lab technology. And then from there, I went on and got my bachelor's degree in biology and a degree in medical technology. Initially, when I came back, I started work at PMH in the lab as a medical technologist. But while I was in the lab, I saw a lot of the young doctors, trainees passing through. And it got me very curious to find out how did they, you know, went off to medical school, so it piqued my curiosity. So I ended up applying to medical school, went to UWI, and as Dr. Bodie said, we all went to UWE, we graduated the same year, and then after successfully completing our medical training, our stomping ground was PMH, which is a very tough place to work. It was a lot of highs and low days. But at the end of the day, we all understood that patient care was the ultimate goal, and we did it with passion and love for the wider community. And then from there, joined the surgical program, where we all basically passed and got our general surgery degree. And currently, I'm getting ready to move on to Canada for a few months, well, almost 2 years, to specialize in colorectal surgery. Then I'll be back here in the Bahamas to, you know, lend my expertise in that area to help the wider public.
Well, I mean, that's very inspiring because even the Right Honorable Philip Brave Davis was out in the media recently and basically was alarmed and at the crisis for young men in this country.
Yeah.
And to see that you did so well,
yeah.
it wasn't easy. You are able to persevere. I think that can inspire a lot of of young men to come up and follow in your footsteps. The women are shining.
Yeah,
we're outnumbered, and even in the surgery department, slowly but surely by women. All the other specialties, even more so.
Yeah.
So we will herald the women. We're proud of them. And I'll say that these two young ladies are pioneers in their own right, because to do surgery as a woman is very, very difficult.
I agree.
It's more difficult than for even for a man.
Yeah.
So let's talk about a little bit of that, Dr. Krista Donich.
Well, thank you for having us, Dr. Pinto.
It's always a pleasure.
Good evening, Bahamas. I have been on this platform, on this show before, but one of the quotes that you opened with, though you may face many a defeat, be not defeated. I think that speaks to this room. We have been through every and all challenge that Princess Margaret has to offer and that the surgical training has to offer. And so we faced it all and we came out on the other end successful. And so I'm proud of this group. And as Dr. Bodhi said, we all graduated from the University of the West Indies in the class of 2014, the three of us in this room. And we have been together since then. So I am a Nassauvian. I was born and raised here in Nassau. I attended primary school first at Xavier's Lower School and then at Tamberley School. And then I went abroad with my mother to the UK and I did high school there. After that, I did a bachelor's degree in anthropology, the study of culture. Yeah. And I really fell in love with infectious diseases. And I began to study and work a lot in HIV and AIDS therapy, which then in college, after college, took me to Cape Town, South Africa, where I spent 1 year with an NGO kind of working on rollout of ARVs in that population, where I think 20% of the population at that time were HIV positive. I couldn't figure out how to marry surgery with infectious diseases, but my love for surgery really had started much earlier watching TV and the way that they romanticized the surgical profession. And I went to University of the West Indies Mona campus in Jamaica. And I thought that the surgeons were the coolest kids there. And having not been a cool kid my entire life, I was like, this time I'm going to be a cool kid. And I surely did take a beating for that choice. But yes, so we are all here now as general surgeons. I returned to Nassau in 2013, did my final year here at the Princess Margaret and have been here since.
You did have some experience, I recall, at New England Journal of Medicine
right,
as well.
Yes. So the fastest way between two points is certainly a straight line, but I don't believe in that. I've taken quite a curvy path. So the surgical training is traditionally about 5 years, but it depends on what it is that you do during that time. And I had taken a break after my first 2 years for 1 year to do a fellowship at the New England Journal of Medicine, and that is the preeminent medical publishing journal. So they publish a lot of the research that we base practice on even today. And so I had an opportunity to sit with a bird's eye view at that journal and watch how medical research is published and how it can change practice. So that was fantastic. That was for 1 year in Boston.
And when we talk about family pressure, everybody knows who your mom is, everybody knows who your dad is, and everybody knows who your uncle is.
What
so
a time.
Let's hear who are they?
Oh, well...
You are the daughter of who?
I am the daughter of Kendall and Ruby Nottage, both of whom are such great orators, and I am so nervous at public speaking all the time, and nobody believes when you've come from a family such as that. And certainly I think each of us in this room can say that we stand on the shoulders of those who've come before us. And our parents have really... Well, they have really towed the line with our training, because all of the times we've been beaten down, all the times we've been defeated, it's really them and our little village of community, whether it be siblings or friends, that had to boost us up every single day. And so I am very grateful for my patronage, for my lineage, my family and my friends. But also, having been Kendall and Ruby's daughter, Kelly and Kenya's sister, they've set up a history of patriotism to the Bahamas. And so many times people look at us and say, oh, all the young people are leaving and they don't want to stay in Bahamas and they don't want to work here. It is tough. It is tough to stay with the opportunities that abound abroad, but I think that the three of us in this room are committed to the Bahamian people, the Bahamian public, and we spend the majority of our time and nights and every single day at the Princess Margaret Hospital.
Agreed.
I mean, it's all-encompassing. There's a meme that I used to see years ago, and one of my friends sent it to me recently, and it was a meme that showed two surgeons in the midst of operating, and it says, the most expensive outfit I've ever worn because it costs me my youth, mental health, stress, sleepless nights, pain, and being far from home. So everything is about sacrifice, okay. And you have to have family that realize that as well, that and friends as well, that you're not going to have time for them.
Yeah.
Your time is not your own. You're basically, you are the glue that and the foundation of a Princess Margaret Hospital.
Agreed.
Surgical department is, I'm probably biased, but I think it's the most important department in any hospital. That along with the emergency room department as well. Mm-hmm. So, Delicia, why did you choose surgery? Did you ever think of any other specialty?
I sure did. Surgery was nowhere near on my radar when I first decided that I wanted to be a doctor. You know, in primary school, high school, you always talk about what you want to do when you're going off to university. I always knew it was medicine, but it was absolutely not surgery and definitely not general surgery. I think my first was pediatrics. I always loved the kids. You know, the ladies, they say, always gravitate toward the kids. So even during summers, I did some rotations at the Rand Memorial Hospital where I would shadow and help with the pediatric population there. Going through rotations in medical school, of course, going through the different specialties, then I'm like, I decided maybe I want something that would be easier hours and 8 to 4. So it was between dermatology. And then I came back home rotating through actual surgical specialties, and then I fell in love with ophthalmology. I actually did want to do ophthalmology, did a year of it rotating in Grand Bahama as well. And I think I wanted a bit more outside of the ophthalmology world, and I made the decision to join the general surgery program.
One thing that's wonderful about Princess Margaret, although it's terrible for our society, is that we have so much in the way of trauma. That gives us a lot of cutting experience that many programs around the world would not ever experience. So that's one of the reasons I went to Cape Town, South Africa. I went to Grootskier Hospital, and Dr. Nottage was also there for some time as well. And that was the place of the very first heart transplant, successful heart transplant in 1967. Mm-hmm. One of my profs actually did the world's first successful penile transplant as well. So a lot of firsts there. They had first world technology. We had robotic assisted surgery. We had laparoscopic for everything. But they also had the pathologies of third world. We also had the trauma. I remember being on call in the trauma room, and there was a drive-by shooting between two gangs, and 27 people came in, one-time shot. Wow. You don't get that kind of experience anywhere. And there were people from around the world, from Italy, from Australia, from even from places like Detroit and Los Angeles, who came there because they know that they would never see so much trauma. I think I've personally seen more trauma than if I was in the Iraq war or Afghanistan war. So that is almost extent where Princess Margaret has. We are a well-oiled machine in terms of getting people to survive. Mm-hmm. I've seen persons survive at Princess Margaret Hospital that wouldn't even have survived at Grootskier Hospital in Cape Town, South Africa, where they are considered one of the best trauma centers in the world. In fact, a lot of groundbreaking studies have come from that trauma department, even in terms of conservative management for low-velocity gunshot wounds, which was unheard of in the past. So you have great cutting skills here. There's no shortage of persons to operate on. Mm-hmm. But what do you think the consequence of so much trauma has on our Princess Margaret Hospital in terms of resources, in terms of draining supplies, in terms of the morale of the staff? How has it affected you? How has it affected your colleagues in terms of, it's very difficult to see so many of our young persons. We can look in the newspaper and say, two drive-by shootings, one stab wound, et cetera, et cetera. But you, Dr. Nottage and Dr. Bodhi, live it. I lived it. Mm-hmm. Our other surgical colleagues live it. So we see. We're there 9 hours trying to save somebody's life, and we know from experience that probably in a year he's going to go and shoot somebody else, or he's going to come back and he shot it himself. How many times are we there 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning trying to save somebody's life, and he was either shot by police or in so many cases he has an ankle monitoring bracelet. How have you seen through the years, and you've been there a number of years even before you entered medicine, how have you seen trauma negatively impact Princess Margaret Hospital?
To start with, I grew up in the Over the Hill community, and you know that community is very troubled, a lot of young men's gang violence, etc. Since becoming a physician,
and let me stop you there. From that point of view alone, you are inspiration. So from where you've come, it's not where you came from, it's where you're headed, and the journey along the way is important, but you've reached the end point where you can be a guiding light to a lot of people who have a lot of dark days. So I would encourage you to go back to your community.
Yeah, definitely.
And go and speak to even primary school. Start from young. Speak to young men and inspire them, because they can have in their mind, you know what, he grew up one street down from me. He grew up on my street. Yeah. He was in the same circumstance, and look where he's what he's achieved.
Yeah.
Against all odds.
Definitely.
Do you want to tell us which area that was, Holly?
So it was right off East Street, Lifebuoy Street.
There you go.
John Chippy Chipman grew up in that street as well.
Okay.
So I use that as a segue to now that I'm a physician or surgeon at PMH, countless times I've seen friends that I grew up with in that area came in the trauma room because of gunshots and stab wounds. A few of my friends, they actually passed away in front of me. So there's like a mental and emotional toll that could wear you down, and it's very emotional. And overall, trauma in any institution, particularly at PMH, it could be a burden on the economy, on the finances of the institution. You know, most of the supplies are essentially free to the public.
And what's the effect on elective surgery? People don't understand.
Yeah.
So they get angry at the surgeons, actually. Yeah. Why are we canceling you? It's to save somebody's life.
If
we need an ICU bed post-op, all the ICU beds are taken up by innumerable trauma. And it plays on your psyche to know that every day you go into the hospital and there are armed police.
Mm-hmm.
There are men shackled, young men who could have had a different path, shackled to beds right next to good citizens. And it's unnerving. Even in the clinics, you have men with automatic weapons, men shackled from their ankles and their and their wrists. And it's like we're in a war zone.
And it
keeps getting worse.
Yeah.
And it keeps getting worse. I remember maybe 4 years ago, 5 years ago, we literally were in a gang war where we would have four people shot every single night for at least 10, 12 days.
Yeah.
Oh, and it's unfathomable that in such a small society, we have so much violence. We have, in terms of population, we're similar to Barbados. Why are we so violent?
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, why do you think that you made it, quote unquote, and your friends did it?
Okay, so definitely, I in life, it's decisions. You could decide to go one way versus the other. At a very young age, I decided I wanted to be better, wanted a better life for my family, and I saw all the sacrifices that my mom made as a single parent in that area, over the hill area, and she instilled all the good morals and, you know, son, work hard in school, think positive, stay away from drugs, gangs, etc. And, you know, I kept that in my mind and in my heart, and I look back at all the sacrifices that my mom made for me and my siblings, and that is what motivated me to be who am I today.
So I always talk about that. You may come from difficult circumstances, but it doesn't have to define you. You may be a maid in the hotel, but you be the best maid, and you make sure that your daughter, your son, reaches higher heights by instilling the importance of education. So Dr. Cristinata, you're a very intelligent young lady, as is Dr. Delicia Bodhi, but what is your take, and why is it that men are in such crisis? Why do we have medical classes from the University of West Indies where it's 80% women, 90% women? Why are the vast majority of specialists coming back from all around the world women? Why are the men falling behind?
Wow. I mean, if I knew Dr. Pinto.
That seems like a question to ask the male in the room, but it's...
Well, okay. I think that we have a problem or maybe a deficit of role modeling. And maybe it's not that the role models don't exist, but it's that the relationships and the recognition of a role model is where we've fallen down. So when we look at previous generations, everyone looked up to someone. And I've asked some of my junior colleagues who are males, who are their role models, and they're kind of not giving me an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And they're fortunate in the field of surgery, especially, to have a role model. You know, for Delicia and I, there are some very strong female leaders who came ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
But really, we are breaking pioneering ground being female general surgeons. But of course, Dr. Colleen Fitzcharles and Dr. Laurette Isaac and many others, Dr. Lockhart, being some of the females who've trod this road before. From young men in our community, I really think it's identifying a role model and establishing a mentor-mentee relationship. I think that there are men who have made it, who maybe aren't taking the time to mentor.
Yeah.
That is something I think that males may benefit more from than the female, because females perhaps have more of an internal system, but we also have a community. I think females tend to talk to each other. They tend to hash things out a bit more, maybe. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly not an expert in this area, but that's kind of what I see with the medical students and trying to figure out why that gap is. Also, this takes tremendous time and dedication mm-hmm. and doing the same thing for a very long time. For mm-hmm. us to have done this, we've been in school literally since we were children till now. And I think for many young males, putting in that time investment without the return financially, without the return maybe socially, is a difficult road to trot in this era where mm-hmm. everything, we're like, they call us what? Microwave generation. We want everything quickly mm-hmm. and the way we want it, the perfect temperature. So we're not willing to put in the work to cook. And we have been cooking a long time, Bahamas. And so that may be part of it. I think mentorship is something that we really have to teach, learn, pass along. And that's something that I've struggled with. Like, I've bought books on how to select your mentor and how to mm-hmm. be a good mentee, how to mentor others. Like, that's a good topic.
And I think there's a lot of misconceptions in the community. They think, oh, you go into surgery because you want to be rich.
Oh, no. No. I wish.
That is the opposite of the truth. The years of struggle that you have to go through.
Yeah.
It was 15 years of struggle where you are on the verge of poverty, living off your family, living day to day. And I remember when I was in residency, I would have high school friends who did business
mm-hmm.
and they would be buying their second house.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I would go to the food store and go to the ATM and I would be in negative balance.
Wow.
Because my credit card was so overdue, the bank withdrew from whatever savings and I was in negative. Yeah. So I had nothing.
Yeah.
So when we come back from specializing, you have negative net worth and you start from nothing.
Yep.
And it's a struggle from there. You don't just develop a name for yourself or mm-hmm. patience or anything else right away. It takes a lot of
time.
And not everyone's going to be successful. And you just have to be in the right place, the right time.
The right time, exactly.
There are other ways to make money. And even if we do have a relatively good income, it's really because we're so busy. It's our family mm-hmm. that we're happy to mm-hmm. enjoy those benefits. It's not really us because we're always in the office. We're always on call. We're always in the hospital and everything else. But you made some wonderful points. I also want to talk about brain drain.
Yeah.
I think a lot of there are some men doing great things, born, raised, men doing great things, but they just don't come home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think more of the women who are successful are coming home.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't blame them for one reason or the other. It's not a very welcome environment.
Yeah.
I've come back. I've had hell. All of you just being in Princess Margaret Hospital, that's even more hell. I don't know how you could have taken it. So there are persons, when they go to Princess Margaret Hospital, they feel depressed, they feel down.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine basically living your whole existence and a great part of your adulthood there, day in and day out, and a lot of things cannot be changed. It's above your pay grade.
Mm-hmm.
You can only deal with the equipment that you're given, and mm-hmm. if it's broken, it's broken. You can only deal with the supplies that you have. And because of trauma, a lot of that is very much depleted. But I think what we need to do is we need to reach out. You two females here can inspire five-year-olds to think into the clouds, to reach for the stars.
Mm-hmm.
Holly, you and Dr. Wesley Francis both came from very difficult mm-hmm. inner city beginnings, but in the inner city, who are the role models?
Yeah.
The drug dealers.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
they're held in the highest esteem. What's the average life expectancy of a drug dealer? But when we talk about education, I've mentioned this before to Dr. Wesley Francis. I would say all of he's accomplished as the first surgical oncologist with a fellowship trained surgical oncologist. There was no fanfare for him. Nobody knows about that or anything else, but if his neighbor or his friend from school shot two people, he'd be on the front page.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
We always emphasize negativity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Good evening. We have a call coming in. This is Urologist Speaks.
Hello, man. How you doing?
Very well. Thank you.
Yeah, I was listening to the conversation about the man.
Yes.
You know, and the underlying problems of being a man. Well, and but I got this phrase that I've come up with, neo-colonialist society.
Okay, yes.
Now, if we play it in that mode, we have to accept the fact that our females, they grow up in an atmosphere that is more nurturing. Not so for our men.
I agree.
Okay? You know, the only men who tend to make it are those who have had some strong mothers or some strong father figures.
Or grandmas, yes.
Who push the concept of discipline, especially in the area of the labor application. Mm-hmm. Now, I think the talk about the drug dealers being the role models.
Yeah, the society is too engrossed with easy money and fast times.
Well, that's the case, but that is a more recent development, in terms of what came out of the late 70s and the 1980s.
Where do you think that there was a shift? When we talk about the 60s, the 70s, where the vast majority of persons in our society, children, were born in a nuclear family with a wedded mother and father. Now it's the opposite, maybe almost 80% or not. Where was the shift between the 70s to the 80s and 90s to now?
That generation that came online in the 1940s, they formed the basis for what happened in 1967. A great number of them got exposure in America.
Yes.
And came home. But I think what went wrong was that the issue of expectation was not dealt with, especially after 67. Okay? Now, when things happened in 67, 68, you saw fractures already in those who had led the struggle, in terms of those persons who they had led out of bondage, were now making demands, right?
Yes.
And those demands were, unfulfilled. When you look at the history, of the dissident eight, and those guys, they struck out because of something. Okay?
Okay.
But what the real problem, I think, came about when, the old GHS was closed down, and the persons who had come to power had gotten their education primarily out of GHS. Okay, they were educated beyond the average masters.
Yeah, so we lost the GHS.
An older politician who had come out of that school actually termed the school as being elitist.
Okay.
Even though that school gave him the foundation. Okay. But what actually caused the problem, in my regard, in my thinking, is that idea of social promotion that came along in the 80s, in the government schools, especially.
Yes.
Where a whole generation, well, I guess a half a generation, was just ushered through, through school, right? And then on the heels of that, we had the influx of drugs starting in the 80s and persons who have come to school without proper education found re-employment in a booming drug trade. You know, quite a few persons of stature in this country right now, you know, can trace their wealth to that era.
Yes, yes, I understand.
But then, you know, we've got this demographic that came out of the 80s. Now, you know, they have children and grandchildren. And that's a very strange place to be. You know, all the guys who have, I guess, about 80% of the guys who get killed in this country now, they know who's going to kill them.
Yes, yes.
You know, so, you know, against that backdrop, you know, you have young persons with expectations, but an avenue to fulfill those is not being given to them by our leaders or those who should be setting an example.
You know, you made some excellent points, but what's the way forward, do you think? Do we need a premier quote DGHS for the government system?
We need to address the issue of expectations, especially for the young persons who are coming up, and create systems and avenues and outlets where those expectations can be addressed and nurtured. You know, I mean, for me, right? You know, I came into school when I was like 14 years old.
Yes, sir.
I had to work anyway.
But you've made some wonderful points, and I thank you very much for your call. You're a lot of food for thought, and I think if we have enough like-minded persons who want to change the future of our country, if we all come together, I think we can find a solution. But thank you very much for your call. So, Dr. Delicio Bodhi, it's very difficult to be a physician, even more difficult to be a surgeon, even more difficult to be a female surgeon. How do you deal with the day in and day out stress, anxiety, depression, seeing people die before your eyes, whether it's from cancer, whether it's from trauma, whether it's a fall, a car accident, young and old, violence, and then you have to go and you got to come back and do it again, and you have to come back and do it again. How do you keep it from breaking your spirit?
That's a very heavy question, and all of us deal with it and or go through it. Whether or not we truly deal with it is another question, and it's something that I constantly face and have to try and compose myself to actually deal with. Several months ago, one of our senior colleagues gave a talk about the second victim. So we always talk about the patient, but what happens to the surgeon who has to live with the complications of their actions? We have the knife in our hand. Whatever happens to the patient thereafter is our responsibility, and we have to accept all consequences. Some things, worst case scenario, we may lose a patient. Sometimes it's a minor complication that we could fix, but nonetheless, whatever complication, it's in our hand. And I think for the most part, myself, Dr. Nottage is one of my go-to persons whenever I am stressed. So we've developed
Same.
A sisterhood
Same, yeah.
when we deal with things. It's having someone you can talk through, process things with. Certain things, if it is that she may not have experienced, I would go to one of my senior colleagues who has been through it and either try and talk to the scenario to see what it is. Sometimes you may not be able to even relate to one of your colleagues. That's where your family support comes in, but you have to have that network in terms of how to process and deal with it. And even sometimes you just may not want to speak to someone else. There are other avenues. Most times I go and run. I have to run the stress out sometimes because Other times you would sit in your thoughts, you would get depressed, you may resort to negative things that you should not be resorting to. So I think one of the most important things is having that network with someone else, someone who is in the field, someone who you can have that discussion with, who you can decompress with, to let whatever those stresses are. And we have to remember at the end of the day, there is just that something innate in us, I think, as well, that keeps us coming back the next day to keep going, keep pushing. As this is what we are here for. We want to help. We want to make persons better. So,
and this is a very violent society. No one is going to debate that. And the devils like to come out at night. As female surgeons, now you've reached a point of having your consultant degrees, and you don't have to be, for the most part, in-house when you're on call. How do you both feel, Dr. Donich and Dr. Bodhi, in terms of your personal safety and worry about your well-being coming out in the middle of the night, all hours in the night? Do you feel safe?
On first hand, sometimes I don't think I think about it. When you're called for a gunshot, I don't think you think, oh, what's going to happen to me?
And the same people who shot these people are on the streets.
Yeah, my thought is I have to go and save that person. So I don't think that's usually my first instinct, which it should be. Our first instinct is that we need to go and save that life, whatever is there, whoever is calling for help. I really don't think about it. And something I think that we need to be more mindful of, because it could be 2 o'clock in the morning
Those streets are deserted, exactly. Dark and deserted. And
the nicest drive is at that time.
Yeah.
But we're very cavalier about leaving our houses at that time. I mean, I live in a complex without a gate, but with neighbors. And so I always imagine that somebody's going to notice, but they don't necessarily. And I don't think about it until it's time to go home, because leaving my house, adrenaline is going. Right. I'm thinking about what I'm going to do, what they told me on the phone, what type of patient I'm going to meet, the steps I might have to take in operating theater. Coming down from that and walking to my car.
That's when we think about
it. Right, from operating theater, I'm like, where's the security? Where did I park again?
Exactly.
How far away was it? I had something happen recently. I was at home. And my car is broken into. And I had gotten home at 2 a.m. And it was 6 a.m. when my neighbor told me that my car is broken into. That made me feel unsafe, because I was like, they probably were watching.
Yeah.
So that means that, you know, people can start watching your routine and your pattern. Oh, this person goes out at night. So it is a little frightening. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is.
And as Dr. Charles Lucas, who was on the show last week, he actually was very forthcoming with a personal issue where he was held at gunpoint and they tried to kidnap him.
Yeah.
And
I remember.
And there are
that,
many stories like that.
Yeah.
And
I remember
so
we're vulnerable in that way.
They're not only vulnerable, but we take a lot of flack. A lot of the public don't know what we as surgeons go through. The same persons who are shooting and stabbing persons are the same persons we have to drive by to get to the hospital to try to save these people.
Yep.
And I've been accosted in terms of verbally and aggressively in terms of taking someone into theater, you better have my boy live.
Yeah.
Or I've had the opposite, and I mentioned it last week, you better not let this person live, or we're going to come back and finish him off and finish you off. And that's a daily, at least now, and those are two decades ago, where the only security you had at Princess Margaret Hospital were old men and women who would maybe throw their keys at someone, but they had no weapon. At least now they have armed defense force officers there, gives you a little bit of security. But I've been in the emergency room where two persons came in, stabbed, and they were the ones who stabbed each other, and they're right next to each other. And when they realize that, they go and attack each other. Wow. And that's happened many times.
Yeah, definitely.
And I've seen nurses being assaulted.
If they're on the same wards, like two.
Exactly.
Like, so you have to be mindful of those things as well. So if someone comes in, two persons who are attacking each other, they have to be on opposite sides
separate
of the hospital.
Wards,
they can't know the other is there.
And the male surgical wards at times could feel like you're at Fox Hill Prison.
It sure can.
There could be eight prisoners, and there could be 15 armed guards.
Officers there with
them. And then you see the granny from your church right there in between. And we have female violent people persons as well.
Yeah.
We have another call coming in. This is Urologist Speaks. Good evening.
Good evening, Dr. Pinto.
How are you doing?
Good evening to your wonderful guest.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Yeah, you know, I was prompted to call because I was frightened by the human story by the young doctor, right?
Yes.
And it really hurts my heart to see that people would target But really and truly, I mean, they shouldn't target any doctor, anybody, right? But a young female professional, it's really scary because my oldest daughter lives by herself, and I wouldn't like to say what she's doing, but she works in the airline industry, et cetera, right?
Yes.
She just recently graduated from UB, but what I'm saying is, it's frightening because I heard the human story, and it's like, wow, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so what I do is, you know, my father was worked in the criminal investigation department for decades, right?
Yes.
And what happened was he used to keep a lot of German shepherds, and some of them were police trained, and they used to be up and down out the yard, and then he started a special one. He used to keep an house. Her name was Elsa.
Yes.
Very smart, maybe 120-pound German shepherd. So we used to feel safe, but sometimes
it's a big girl.
Mm-hmm. It may be a little expense, but sometimes it's good to have like a guard dog, really and truly, because I mean, mm-hmm. I have a cousin who trains them, but I'm saying they come in so handy sometimes because they deter people.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
it's really frightening in hearing the stories. And then Dr. Pinder said some doctor was almost kidnapped. I mean, you know, it's the degradation.
Actually kidnapped.
It's really,
he was kidnapped.
I remember the story that the two culprits were arguing over who was going to get the ATM money, and when they were distracted, he jumped out the car.
What? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm back. But anyway, a human story, because I was also impressed with the doctor and the kinds of, like, I'm comparing to what I do because I work long hours, but, you know, fixing furniture and stuff like that, cars, house furniture and stuff. And and she said that when she went to the parking lot, she can't remember where she parked, and so she's drunken with her work and spent with her work, which is, I was moved by that. And I was like, given that I know the type of doctor Dr. Pinto is as far as sincerity and disclosing the truth, and hopefully all doctors should be.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, from a patient's perspective, I've seen those things, so you're not being on the ward for like a month, and then like a month and a week, right, Dr. Pinto?
Yes.
And I've seen suffering and death also. But I'll share this with you guys. You know, when I came out of the hospital the last time, which was the longest, it was a month and a week, and people called me and say, oh, what happened? Wait. But, you know, Dr. Pinder had prolonged bleeding from this surgery. But, and as I came, my first ride out of the hospital, and I was traversing down East Street and et cetera, and I was just looking. Everything looked so, I can't say, like I needed orientation again. Like, everybody looked so, life looked so meaningless. Like, people just looked pathetic doing, like, I just couldn't believe, like, so many people doing so much idle things. Like, I look at life in a different way. Like, all of a sudden, as I reach 58, 60, like, 24 hours a day is not enough for me. And I was like, where I was all of this time, like, you know, wasting, like, when I can see you back in the days, you know, you would waste time partying and going out with friends and doing all kinds of, I used to smoke weed, et cetera. You know what I'm saying, Dr. Pinto?
Well, let me just ask this, 52. Sorry for disrupting you and interrupting you.
No problem.
But you've had a colorful past. You've been on the radio many times, I'd admit it.
Yeah.
You stabbed someone. You were in Fox Hill prison.
But
how did you turn your life around? Because you call a lot of radio shows. You are very intelligent, very well-read. You inspire a lot of people.
I don't know.
How did you turn your life around from negative to positive?
I live long enough, and I get to see the folly. Like I always tell young people, even if I look back in retrospect or self-actualization, like some of the things that I did, I would never say on the radio, but I'm ashamed. And sometimes I'd be glad I lived through it, and then I'd be like, if you look back, it's almost like, I don't know if it's God in the sky, you'll see how foolish you really are or were. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like mind-boggling. You know, it's unbelievable. You can't do these things again. But I like to, you know, like talk to young people because I mean, there's so much folly out there. I listen to you guys talk about what's going on with the young men. Cleve always pushing that. But if he was to teach, there is hidden racial agendas already. Then there would be some impediment to destroying ourselves. You know, because it's tit for tat. Something is out amiss, man. Something is afoot. I mean, it really. But I'll just hang up and finish this. And I mean, I'm upset too because. You know, I really didn't know I was going to live this long, and so I look at it. I'm not, people say 60 months is not long, but it's long, you know, I mean, for me, in the human journey, because it's just like you have to share now, so that's what you guys have to do. You have to share your experiences.
Mm-hmm.
But I was impressed with the young doctor's human story, because that means she has a lot of love. And so, you know, I just hope all doctors would do that and be sincere.
Mm-hmm. You know, so we're just trying to say that there are a lot of positive things coming out of PMH. Right in front of me, this is the future of surgery in the country.
Yeah, but doctor, you know, I've been in the hospital that long enough to know that, it, of course, because I had a nurse was even around me to take my medication, you know. What her name was? Nurse Dorset, you know. So have a good night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
So that's all important. We need to talk about positive things, and we can't give up on the community. Another troubling issue that I've seen through the decades at Princess Margaret Hospital, and I'll send that to question out to you, Dr. Holly Knock Nixon. Mm-hmm. What is the cost of illegal immigration on our public health system on PMH in terms of the overburdening illegal immigration. We all rotated through obstetrics and gynecology. Mm-hmm. We all mm-hmm. saw where, mm-hmm. in certain days, 80% of the babies born were born to illegal persons, mm-hmm. primarily Haitian. Mm-hmm. We would be in emergency room where 70% of the persons yeah. taking up the trolley are illegal. I found it troubling 25 years ago, even more so. I remember one time I was on call. Seven persons came in. They were in a packed car. They were all drunk, smelling like liquor. None of them had seatbelts on. All of them had blunt trauma, fractures, head trauma. We were overwhelmed. Every one of them couldn't speak any English. Yeah. They're all, yeah. And the burden, the amount of resources just for those seven people, and I remember five of them had to go in for surgeries. Mm-hmm. It's just overwhelming. Yeah. It's just overwhelming, and that's crippling our healthcare system.
Yeah, definitely.
So we can't give the police officers a raise. We can't give the defense force mm-hmm. officers a raise. We can't give the raises to the nurses
or doctors,
because yeah. we're so overwhelmed. Where yeah. persons come in, I know persons who would come to urology clinic at PMH, and I would speak to them. They'll be forthcoming. They have no fear at all. They'll say, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, or I was diagnosed with kidney cancer, mm-hmm. so I snuck into the Bahamas to get free healthcare.
Oh, okay.
What do you think the burden is from what you've seen over the many years, from you being in every aspect of the hospital? Mm-hmm. What's the burden of immigration on our public health system?
Yeah, most certainly. The population in our country, let's say, 400,000, that's not counting the undocumented persons who are here. Mm-hmm. And everyone who shows up at the hospital, obviously you cannot turn them away. So the burden is high, most or mainly in the obstetric area, where, you know, a lot of the foreign nationals, they would come and have their babies on those wards. For the most part, if you think about it, there's a strain on the staff, the doctors, the nurses. It's a strain on the financial allocation for that department, particularly obstetric and gynecology. And even in cases where trauma, a lot of foreign nationals, you know, they would get involved in illegal activities, gang violence, et cetera. And all of that will, you know, pile up and compound on the pre-existing problem that we already have. But definitely, the numbers, we don't have exact numbers, but anyone could take an educational guess and say yes. It's a burden financially.
It's a boiling point. What are your thoughts, Dr. Nottage?
I wanted to add to the conversation. The Princess Margaret Hospital, from my understanding, was built on a model of a population that we have exceeded a long time ago.
Yeah.
Even the complement of physicians and consultant staff was to cater to a population that was far smaller than we have now. But if I were to take a slightly different angle, I would say, yes, foreign nationals, based on them adding to the number burden at Princess Margaret Hospital, are adding to the strain of the running of the institution. And it's not the only nationality that we're all thinking. It's not just that. We're quite seasoned, if I can put it that way. Our population is quite seasoned. And I know that the three of us sitting here can say that some of the most interesting cases we have done have been on persons who belong to our migrant populations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So things that the textbook says is 1 in 500,000, and Princess Margaret has it. Yeah. So, and I mean, when we think about pediatric surgery, some of the tracheoesophageal fistula surgeries we've done, anorectal malformations, I mean, these are in patient populations that we would not otherwise have served. Now, those surgeries cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, right, for the government. And the recovery of those patients is very, very expensive. And so you can think of it that way. So it's a plus and a minus. We've benefited from the diversity, but at the same time, the hospital
is
under a lot of strain.
I think the greatest burden, and I've seen that through the decades, is actually in the ICU.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And the IMCU, where in the NICU, there are children who are born because of lack of antenatal care, who were born with disorders, premature, lung disorders, congenital abnormalities, etc. And it costs the government system, Princess Margaret Hospital, millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Millions and millions of dollars. Yeah. And it's never ending.
I don't know, did Dr. Francis mention that a team at Princess Margaret had a separation of conjoined twins.
No. That is also something very positive.
Yeah, yes, that's very positive coming out. Princess Margaret did that.
No one will talk about that.
No.
This one had a bed sore or this one.
We have the most advanced neonatal ICU south of Florida, from what I've heard. Mm-hmm. Anybody can fact check me, but I think that's what's going on. And we fly in infants right from the Caribbean to our institute, to the Princess Margaret Hospital. Yep. That people want to poo-poo all the time. I mean, occasionally we poo-poo it because we're tired of going there every day, all night. But
So I know, Dr. Bodie, you're interested in minimally invasive surgery. That's a future of surgery. I know that Dr. Holly Nixon wants to do colorectal surgery. That's a major problem in our country that's overwhelmed with colorectal cancer. Mm-hmm. And the surgical oncologist, Dr. Krista Nottage, we're, again, overwhelmed with cancer. And I know all three of you are coming back.
Yes, definitely.
Even though it might be tough coming back. So things do look bright. So we need to stop knocking our Princess Margaret Hospital. The future looks bright. I am a little older than you guys, and I think I got 25 more years left in me. I'm sure you guys got 35 more years in you. So you are the future, and the future looks bright because you have that caring heart, each one of you. I've worked with all of you through the years. What would you say, Dr. Bodie, to someone out there who's 10 years old and wants to think about going into surgery as a young female, and she doesn't see anybody, maybe a few people on Grey's Anatomy that she can aspire to, but you are the living flesh in her 21x7 mile island that she can aspire to, just like Dr. Colleen Fitzcharles and Dr. Krista Nottage.
Yeah, I first would want to make sure that this is what she wants to do, not what anyone else wants her to do. Even my mother, her discovering my decision to become a doctor, she said, I never told her anything. My mom was a primary school educator, recently retired. My father is a maritime pilot. So nobody in healthcare to say I'm following mom and dad's footsteps. It has to be her own decision to do so. And the second thing I would tell her is what Dr. Robin Roberts, a great urologist, told us when we came back home. Medicine is a jealous lover. Mm-hmm. You accepting this decision, this responsibility of becoming a physician, you have to, one, accept that it's going to require a lot of sacrifice, and you have to be willing to sacrifice a lot of yourself to help the greater population, if it's something that she truly desires. It is a lot that it weighs on us sometime, but the reward of seeing persons recover, saving lives, is very fruitful, very rewarding to us, and that's something that we look forward to.
And we all have support, and whether we have, it's a wife or a husband, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a mother, aunt, when we go out on call, those we live with, they usually have sleepless nights because they're worried about us coming back home safe. Mm-hmm. So I, even from my wife's perspective, I was on call half my life for PMH. And I might be called 2-3 times out in the same night. And my wife would have a sleepless night. And that's the burden that being married or in a relationship or having a child who's a surgeon, it's far-reaching. It's not just the sacrifice for you as an individual. And you have to realize that sometimes you come home and you're just completely drained. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would come home quiet and my wife knows she'll never ask about patients' privacy or diseases or anything else. I'll speak in generalities. Mm-hmm. And maybe I won't even realize I'm a little bit quiet, but then I realize she might mention, why are you a little bit down? And I'll think, you know what? I had to tell 5 people today they had cancer. Mm-hmm. And 4 of them broke down with their family and cried. Mm-hmm. And that's a heavy burden to it. And we do it all the time. Yeah. We do it all the time. Every time we have a trauma case come in, we have to go out and tell the family what is expectation. Mm-hmm. Are they likely to live? Did they not? Yeah. Did they succumb to their? And we've heard all the streaks, the screaming, the collapsing on the ground, the everything else. And over and over and over with this violent society, we see so much of it. Yeah. We see the horrors of our society, and that can bring us down. But we still go forward. Mm-hmm. That is not spoken up enough. And that there are good people, good behaving young people who are doing positive things and they're uplifting. Yep. We're taking surgery department, we're speaking about surgery department, pediatrics are doing great things, obstetrics and gynecology, they're doing great things, other disciplines are doing great things, but where we're talking about, we're taking it to the next level in terms of minimally invasive surgery, in terms of having every subspecialty within Princess Margaret Hospital that you can find anywhere in the world. We go off as you guys have done. You did your base training here. You got excellent training. You got great surgical skills. The only reason, it's very competitive to get any fellowship post. Mm-hmm. There are people applying from all around the world. Mm-hmm. So for you and all of the people who went before you and those who are going to come after you to get a post, that shows that this program is a very solid and well-respected program. And when you go off and the next person 10 years comes from the same program, they're going to realize that you've paved the way because of that. Yes. Yeah, and that's only where we're going to succeed if we keep coming back. Mm-hmm. I've mentioned it before, and someone called in and said, how do we solve the problem of a lack of physicians in our country? And they said, do we just bring in Cuban doctors? And I said, what we need to do, and I'll ask you this, Dr. Krista Nottage, I think we need to reach out to all the Bahamians who never came home. All of them who love their country, have their mother here, have their father here. Mother and father might be getting older. They would love to be in the same country as them. Did all their high school here, have all their friends and cousins here. Why don't we entice them to come back and revolutionize the medical system publicly and privately and benefit the country? How do we do that? And don't you think that should be the foremost thing that we need to do in terms of recruiting physicians? It should be recruiting our own.
Yeah, I think that would be a very positive move for our future, and I think that maybe we are the people to make it happen. Another quote from Dr. Roberts, he always said, a rising tide carries all ships. And so we have to decide if we're going to set the pace and be that rising tide and bring along those people. I think that the persons who are abroad just can't envision themselves working within the constraints of our local healthcare system. Mm-hmm. They've probably trained in institutions that have more. They're practicing with more. And to come home and have to make do with, you know, a Q-tip and an alcohol swab is very difficult. Mm-hmm. But instead of seeing it as an individualistic prospect, we have to see it as a nation-building project. Mm-hmm. And so it's not that we want you to come back. You're not going to do the same thing you did when you were away, but you're going to build our nation. And if that is important to you, if that is something that you want to contribute to, then we want some of your time. And maybe we don't ask them to come home forever. Maybe we ask them to dedicate locums to us, because having strength in the diaspora is also important. When we meet Jamaicans abroad or Haitians abroad or people from Trinidad and Tobago abroad, they're in the diaspora and they're feeding back to their community, right? Mm-hmm. So which ways can we engage them to give back locally?
And what I mentioned with Dr. Charles Lucas last week, when we go off to these places in Florida and in New York and California and Toronto, a lot of the persons who are in senior positions in terms of surgery came from the Caribbean. It's just that many of us who trained with them happen to come back to our own country.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they'd rather go off to Toronto. Mm-hmm. They'd rather go off to Cleveland Clinic and University of Miami. We're the same trained persons. In fact, we might have better skills because we do more with less. Mm-hmm. Any closing words, Dr. Bodie? And we have to have both of you back, all three of you back, because this is inspiring.
Yeah.
And I think we need to speak more positively about Princess Margaret Hospital and the future of PMH.
I'd just like to thank you again for the opportunity and just want to encourage those who do want to follow in our footsteps and take that healthcare journey, that if it's something you really want to do, you're dedicated to it, go for it. Just know that you have to be full-hearted, dedicated to it.
Dr. Holly Nixon?
Yeah, I share the same sentiment as Dr. Bodie. Thank you again for having me on the show. But yes, I would encourage, especially young men, you know, just basically make the right choice. It's better that way. It's going to be hard, but hard work pays off. Put God first, etc. And yes, there's a lot of positive things coming out of Princess Margaret Hospital.
Dr. Kristen Onich.
Okay, thank you so much for having us on the show, Dr. Pinto. Thank you for trying to highlight up-and-coming talent that is part of nation building.
I think we need to make this a series.
Yes, but I must mention before we sign off that my dad is from the exact same area as Holly Nixon, and I would be crucified if I got home and did not say that my dad is from East Street in the same area, same corner as Holly Nixon. And I'm proud of the two that I work with, and we certainly lift each other up. And so thank you for having us.
Thank
you. Okay, have a good night, Bahamas. Be safe, and we'll speak again in another week. Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Put that in your pencil, make you feel like a champion. Rise up again, let nothing keep you down.
problems, and 96.